everyone. We'd like to call the committee to order. A quorum is present, and we have quite a full agenda today. This was going to be a day on which we didn't even hear any bills, so we've got quite a few bills to hear for bills for a non-bill hearing day. So we're going to be here all afternoon or through our regular committee time, and then we're intending to recess and reconvene this evening to finish our agenda, including that we have posted the first draft of our omnibus bill. It's online, and we will be walking through that this evening when we reconvene. So give people a little bit of a chance to take a look at that, and then we'll be walking through it. But no testimony will be taken on that today, just so everybody knows. But in the meantime, we're going to take up House File 1992. Representative Dean. And again, I just would like to comment for the audience, and I don't know if we're on TV here. Maybe we are. No? Okay. But, you know, for anyone who's new to the process, members are often in multiple committees that are meeting at the same time. And so if you see members walking in and out, it's not because they are ignoring the testimony or not interested in the subject. It's because they need to be in multiple places at the same time. So just want to, including the chair. So,
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Can I move Representative Dean's bill, please?
You may. Thanks. So, Representative Abler moves House File 1992 that it be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And there's also an A3 amendment, Representative Dean?
Madam Chair, yes, I believe there's an A3 amendment.
Okay, and Representative Abler is going to move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like it discussed. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. So, Representative Dean, welcome back to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, and go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill before you today, House File 1992, is a bill that actually advocates on both sides of this issue have been working on for the past 8 months to come to an understanding and agreement. It addresses the issue of the waiver, home community-based waiver, the 25% rule that's been in place for several years now. And rather than me going through the bill, I am going to turn it over to Chuck Peterson with Clare Housing and let him spell out what they've been working on for the past few months. So I have a couple testifiers, and then ultimately I'll also have a few other individuals that might be able to help out with some questions that, that folks will have. So,
okay, thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Chuck Peterson, and I serve as the Executive Director of Clare Housing and Chairperson for the Coalition for Choice in Housing. We're a diverse and growing coalition of tenants, advocates, individuals, families, and providers who believe that all Minnesotans with disabilities deserve to have meaningful choice in housing. Our membership includes approximately 25 organizations that collectively provide affordable housing and supportive services to thousands of Minnesotans each year. We're here today, as Representative Dean indicated, to seek your support of House File 1992, which addresses some of the unintended impacts of Minnesota Statute 256B.492, which establishes a no more than 4 or 25% statutory limitation on the number of people on waivered services that can reside in a single setting. After months of productive conversations with a full spectrum of stakeholders, including NAMI Minnesota, the ARC Minnesota, Mental Health Association of Minnesota, and the Disability Law Center, we come before this committee with what we and many have described as peace in the valley. At the heart of our compromise is an exception process to the existing statute, specifically the process which was principally drafted by the Disability Law Center, provides a pathway for granting an exception from the requirement in paragraph A3, which restricts the number of individuals receiving services under HCBS waiver that may reside in a single or multifamily building. and it also grants an exception from the requirement in paragraph B3 that the setting cannot be a housing complex designed expressively around an individual's diagnosis or disability. After consulting with a broad array of stakeholders, including tenants, advocates, individuals, families, local units of government, and providers, the Department of Human Services will be required to accept applications by January 1st, 2015 from the owner, operator, or developer of a community living setting for an exception to the statutory limitations. As a coalition, we believe the time to act on this legislation is now for the following reasons. The existing statute is creating confusion and uncertainty for both tenants and providers, as it is not being enforced uniformly across counties, if at all. Tenants fear that they may lose their home, and providers are potentially being faced with denying housing based on an individual's disability. Second, at a time when there is a substantial demand for quality housing options, private market landlords, whom many of us work with to provide scattered site housing, are concerned that they may be out of compliance with existing statute and therefore are choosing to no longer accept potential tenants being referred from service providers. Thirdly, private and public financing is at risk and at times of being denied or delayed as a result of the uncertainty of enforcement. And finally, the existing statute is in conflict with both the state Olmstead Plan and the recent release of the CMS rules around home and community-based services, where notably, arbitrary limitations, including a blanket ban on disability-specific complexes, were studied and rejected. In addition, this exception process that we've worked on has earned the support of multiple housing providers, residents and tenants, local units of government, and disability advocates alike, because people with disabilities will continue to have meaningful choice in housing. It ensures and supports full integration into the community. It ensures accountability. It meets the quality standards required by the Supreme Court's decision in Olmstead and new heightened CMS rules for waivered services. And it leaves in place this current statutory limitations, ensuring we won't have a saturation of only one specific type of housing. We believe the process we have outlined is consistent with CMS rulings and Minnesota's Olmstead's plan. As the Department of Human Services develops its CMS compliance plan, which you'll hear about shortly, over the next year, now is the right time to advance this legislation so we can continue to work collaboratively to ensure that our state laws better balance the values we all share of choice, integration, accountability, and quality. In conclusion, I want to thank Representative Dean for his support and encouragement of this process, our partners, including NAMI Minnesota, the ARC Minnesota Mental Health Association of Minnesota, and the Disability Law Center. Over the course of several months of respectful conversations, we've arrived at a thoughtful compromise that we feel is the right solution at the right time for people living with a disability in Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And members, if it's okay with everybody, I'd like to get through the testifiers before we start taking questions. So we're going to call the next testifier, Benjamin Ashley Wertman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of this committee, my name is Ben Ashley Wertman. I represent the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. This spring, we're celebrating 75 years of being a guiding light for Minnesotans living with mental illnesses. As mentioned, in cooperation with the ARC Minnesota, NAMI Minnesota, and Minnesota Disability Law Center, we've been in conversation with the Coalition for Choice in Housing. We really believe that we can all be proud of the result of these negotiations. When we were first approached, the option on the table was a straight repeal, and we had the following issues with it. The 25% cap is a valuable, if overly blunt, tool. The trajectory of housing and services for people with disabilities across the nation and in Minnesota is more integration, more scattered site. This trajectory has clearly been charted at the federal level. The HUD H-811 housing program used to sponsor 100% disability-specific projects. It is now supporting scattered site, including 95 units here in Minnesota. Olmstead, the new CMS HCBS regulations. All of it is pushing the state to be accountable for and a responsibility for providing meaningful choice and access to scattered site housing. We know that our housing dollars, our services dollars are scarce, so we need to fund projects that are going to be meeting the needs for years to come and continue to be reimbursable over the life of the building. There is significant work that needs to happen in order to successfully plan for the implementation of the new CMS regs. We can't move too far nor too fast, but we can do something now. There is significant work remaining in terms of building these laws, these practices, these rules, and indeed the organizations that are going to be capable of offering this true choice in housing. So the second major concern that we had was with oversight and quality. Poor quality housing projects for people with disabilities is a recent memory, especially in the mental health community. Increased social isolation and a lack of housing options makes people vulnerable to accepting whatever housing they can get, even when it is deficient or unsafe. We believe that sunshine is a disinfectant. When the 25% rule makes sure that other people are in the building, the people who are capable of reporting problems and standing up for better housing quality. When we replace organic oversight, we need thoughtful policy, and that's what we believe the exceptions process represents. More closely integrates higher density settings into a continuum of housing options. Providers will be incentivized to show support for transition in a number of different ways, according to the strengths that they bring as a particular provider. Different providers with different approaches will have whatever resources they bring to the table, and it will reward a range of contributions towards building a better housing system in Minnesota. Housing providers will be held to quality standards that make sense for the population that they will be serving. Some providers we've been meeting with are already striving to set best practices. We want to reward that as much as possible. We're giving DHS the appropriate authority to weed out the bad apples. Finally, we believe that the exemptions process will bring advocates and residents together with an opportunity to comment and shape the proposed exemptions process and projects as they move forward. The scope of the exemption, the nature of the demand for more concentrating housing will need to be considered in the application and discussed. We'll be able to meet those state obligations that I've mentioned under the new CMS regs. The settings will be built as part of a broad spectrum of housing options, and we do not want them over nor underbuilt. I've seen my options. This is what I want is a great reason for somebody to choose a housing setting. This is the only thing that's been offered to me is a very poor reason to choose that. A thoughtful exemptions process means a smarter and sharper tool for ensuring scattered site housing and a true range of housing options. I look forward to the stakeholder meetings. We've built a lot of trust over the past couple of months, and finalizing the details of the application process, I believe it's going to be something that is going to produce good public policy. On behalf of the Mental Health Association of Minnesota, NAMI Minnesota, the ARC of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Disability Law Center, I would ask that the committee consider the exemption process represented here before you today to be the preferred solution for the issues surrounding the 25% concentration limit. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Zach Johnson?
First of all, can everyone hear me okay?
Oh, yes. Yes. Very good.
My name is Zach Johnson, and I'm here to talk today about a choice I made 10 years ago to live in a housing setting where my housing and personal care attendant services were combined to give me the flexibility of 24-hour personal care attendant service when I needed it. This 24-hour personal care assistant service allowed me the flexibility to finish my degree in sports marketing and management with a minor in political science from the University of Minnesota, because you all know that sometimes an 11 a.m. 11 p.m. term paper is unavoidable. and this allowed me to not have to choose between finishing my term paper and going to bed. Imagine having to make that choice. Well, the 24-hour service provider allowed me not to have to make that choice. I also serve on the local volunteer amateur radio club in my community, and this 24-hour service allows me to serve any shift I want. Sometimes I serve the night shift because if somebody gets lost, I'm easy to find. They just say, "Go look for the guy in the big black chair." And the kids can find me, and they're not scared. I usually end up giving them a ride back to their parents. And if I lost the 24-hour service, I would no longer be able to do that. In closing, what I'd like to say is the 24-hour service combined with my housing allows me to live my life on society's time. And live to society's standards, not someone with a disability standards, society as a whole. And that, my friends, is what integration is all about. Not simply the building that you live in. So on that note, I would please ask for your vote so we can move forward on this legislation. And thank you for allowing me testify today.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Johnson. We appreciate your presence. Please, we can't have any applause in the committee room. But thank you very much. Kathy Lamp. And please stick around. There might be questions later, Mr. Johnson. We're holding all the questions till the end. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
You're going to want to pull that mic close to you now. There we go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, my name is Kathy Lamp. I'm a lobbyist for Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. And on behalf of our board, which is meeting right now, just wanted to bring forward our support for the efforts of Representative Dean to keep the open dialogue and focus on client-centered services in this area. Our own board has really wrestled with a number of these issues. And we have a county board position that I'll just read, which says that Hennepin County Board supports the current negotiations in process at the legislature for supportive housing to ensure that any changes to racial restrictions are client-centered first to safeguard against institutionalizing people with disabilities. So we really support the efforts and are appreciative of Representative Dean and these efforts to open up this conversation and keep it open for us to continue to evolve options for people.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Lamb. Alice Hulbert. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Alice Hulbert. I am a member of the State Quality Council, but I'm not here today to speak on their behalf because we have not had this brought before us and we have no position on it. But I'm also the parent of a 29-year-old young man who's living in a house with support in the community. It's his own home. It's not a group home. And when I first heard about this piece of legislation, I was told, we have to do this because there are too many important programs that could be disqualified if we don't. I was concerned about the possibility of institutions coming back. And I was told, we're going to work to try to make sure that doesn't happen, but we're over a barrel and we have to get this done. So I didn't think too much about it until earlier today when I ran into somebody in the hall who said, you know, you need to look a little more closely at this. I've thought about quality a lot in the last 2.5 years on the Quality Council, and I've been at the Olmstead meetings, and I've sat on the committee with 245D. I understand where everybody is trying to get to with person-centered planning and with the kind of supports where people have choice in making their decisions. And my concerns with this legislation is that there's not enough in it right now to ensure that people are going to have choice and that we're not going to be overwhelmed by somebody who wants to put in a 400-bed facility, and all of a sudden you get your waiver, and that's the only place that's available, because there's not very much scattered site housing right now. So I think those kinds of protections have got to be in place before we go forward with this. The moratorium on four-person group homes has put, you know, a severe break on people being able to move to other settings. So I think there's a lot of desperation out there to try to find another way. And I think there are other ways, and we need to make accommodations for that. But there's just not enough protection in the bill as it's written right now. Specifically, there's no requirement that there's a separation of the housing provider and the service provider. That's just vitally important, so that a person, when they rent a place, assuming that they'll be able to have a lease, can stay there if they decide that the service they're getting isn't what they want and they want a different service provider. They should be able to stay. There should be a cap on how many of these institutions can be built so that we're not suddenly overwhelmed. I mean, a typical developer's got to go out and get some pre-sales before they build something. So I would hope there's going to be some kind of effort to be sure that it's not being overbuilt. And there also needs to be a cap on how many people can be put in one of these facilities to make sure that there are choices for people. I'm also concerned about the quality and the oversight. There's nothing in this bill that guarantees that. I mean, right now they would say that there's a quality in waivered services. My son has received waivered services for 10 years, and I have never been asked about the quality of services, nor have any of my friends who have individuals and their family receiving waivered services. It's a tough area, and I don't think it's been fleshed out enough, and I think we need to do better before everything is left to be determined. So I think that we should make sure that these places as constructed are really a person's home over which they have some control, and we build in the kind of safeguards that need to be there. They're not there yet. I was on a city council, as I think a lot of you know, and for a city to bring in a new development, it takes multiple layers. You don't go have one hearing and say, okay, we're building now. You know, you've got the planning commission, and you've got to notify all the neighbors, and you've got to go through the council after that. There's multiple spots where it's checked. I think one process is not good enough for what we've got. So I would ask you not to support this bill as written. We need to do better with the exception process, and it needs to be fleshed out and make sure that we're not overbuilding, that people's choices are not going to be limited to just the one that's left, and that there are multiple inputs along the way, not just one. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Colbert. And this, if the bill clears the committee today, it's going to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. So discussions can continue, and we appreciate your input today and hope that if the bill passes, or even if it doesn't, that you will work with the author to give him your suggestions, because I think yours is a voice that is you know, very much needed here. So we appreciate you being here and giving us your input today.
Thank you.
We'd like to also hear from somebody from DHS, and I don't know who the person is who's going to come down, but very good. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Alex Bartolik. I'm with the Disability Services Division at the Department of Human Services, and I'm not here to take a position on the bill. But you've been hearing a lot about these new CMS regs and what's going on, and I just wanted to give you a little bit of context of what has been happening. Home and community-based services in Minnesota and all over the country are expanding, and there was a lot of work being done through the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal government, who authorizes our use of waiver dollars, home and community-based service, Medicaid-funded services, in looking at how to really assure sure that we're meeting the Americans with Disabilities Act, that we're in compliance with the Olmstead and some of the principles of integration in the community. And so they've been tackling our services to really try to make sure that there's some parameters. They issued several draft rules that would affect settings. And a few years ago, the draft rule that was promulgated said that they would not allow disability-only services, and that that was one step to try to allow and assure for integration. And as people have said, now we have our final rules. They're out. It's fairly recent. We're still making our way through what this means. And in fact, I just saw that they've just issued some additional guidance today. So we're all still trying to figure out what how to implement these rules. But they did take away the disability only, and instead, they put in a provision that talks about assuring that services in the setting don't isolate people from their communities. And there's some different pieces. Now, this new rule is not just about settings. This new rule is about how do you plan for people. How do you assure that they have choices that are real, meaningful choices so that they can make decisions for themselves? How do you assure quality in different ways? So there's a lot of components in addition to this. And we have a responsibility to be able to put this in place. We will have 5 years to develop a plan to assure that all of our services and settings under our home and community-based service programs, which are 5 waiver programs, including elderly waiver, a waiver for people with developmental disabilities, our waiver for people with brain injury, our CAC waiver for people with hospital level of care, as well as our CADI waiver, which is for people who have disabilities. These 5 waivers have to be in full compliance within 5 years. And there's a lot of nuances to this. We can define what a setting is and what it isn't in Minnesota, but then whether the person experiences that way is a whole nother level of quality we have to assure. So what we are intending to do, because it's complex, you're hearing a lot about these different issues. We also know that there are people living in settings right now that will not be able to continue living in those settings, or services can't continue the way they are without some changes in the end of 5 years. We want to be very thoughtful. So we are intending to introduce a plan to CMS. CMS has to approve our plan. They have to approve how we're going to go about this. They have to approve how we're going to monitor it. And they have to monitor, and then they will approve how we are monitoring it. So we are intending to issue a plan to them soon that outlines the steps we're going to take over the next year to really look at defining the services, defining the settings, how we're going to monitor it. We need a lot of stakeholder involvement. There's a lot of unintended consequences that could happen if we weren't careful. So we're developing a plan to do our full implementation plan, and our goal is for next session to have some language also for you to consider. So again, I'm not taking a position on the bill. I just wanted you to understand the context that we are working with and some of the actions that we'll be taking in 2014 to prepare for next session and to give CMS a blueprint for how we would like to proceed.
Right. And so, Ms. Bartolik, in the plan that you're talking about, how does this issue figure, the one that we're here discussing? What is DHS going to take a position on this for purposes of putting that plan forward?
We don't know for sure what CMS is going to approve, and that's one reason why we are really just trying to focus on what we have to do. We are going to be looking at what are the criteria, and it's clear that the coalition that's been working on this has been trying to really wrestle with what are some of the criteria. We will need to be able to say to CMS what criteria will we use, and have them agree with it, and we're not in a position to do that right now. Our plan to do a plan would hold silent on this unless there was something that we felt violated, what our conditions were. We already know, for example, our current definition of home and community-based services allows for a grandfather clause. It allows certain facilities that were open as of a certain date to continue, and CMS has told us they will not allow a grandfather. They will allow a transition. So we know that we just have a lot of time to work through this in developing our own plan.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Bartolik. And I have another member on the list. First, before we go to questions, though, I'm going to ask whether there's anyone else in the room who wanted to testify for or against the bill. Okay, please come forward.
Right over here. Right over here. Is the chair to The other end.
Other way.
That's my chair. That's my chair. Your chair's over here to your right.
One person here doesn't mean anything.
Right, right. Yeah, to your right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Gotta find the microphone.
You're good.
Here we are.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chris Bell, and I'm here representing the American Council of the Blind of Minnesota. And I did submit some written testimony, which I don't know whether you have received yet.
We do have that, Mr. Bell.
Thank you. My goal here is not to speak in favor of or against this particular bill. I certainly can understand why people with disabilities would want to live together. I mean, living with temporarily able-bodied people is not a bunch of yucks all the time. For example, I had an assistant that my wife and I employed who was to do a number of things for us, including match our clothing. When I was told I had on socks of two different colors, she responded, and I should say rather indignantly, "What do you care? You're blind. You can't see them." They go into restaurants with sighted friends, and the server comes over and says, "Does he like carrots?" What do you mean? So, well, I go to Target and buy a small item with a $20 bill, and the person who's doing the checkout gives the change to my sighted friend. And I go, "Hello. If I give you the money, you give me the change." So I understand the desire to have choice and the desire to choose, in fact, to live in a disability-only building. But our concern is very much the same points that were raised by Alex Bartolik and the previous witness whose name I'm sorry I don't remember was on the Quality Council. I think that right now, this state and many others are in the middle of a federal push and pull. On the one side, there are people who see themselves as quote-unquote true integrationists who do not believe that we should recreate many institutions. On the other side are people like Zach and others who say, look, we're entitled to choice. We want to choose where we want to live, and we don't want to have this particular choice of living in a disability-specific home taken away from us. So the reality is, this really hasn't been decided. So as Alex Bartolik pointed out, in the existing current legislation, 256B.492, we've grandfathered institutions that were open as of, I think, July 2012. You know, that's not going to work, as she said. So we have to think about how we are going to deal with those issues. How will we deal with the issues brought up by the woman who testified who was on the Quality Council? Those are very important issues. We haven't dealt with issues of how many of these disability-only houses can you have. There is concern in some quarters that, you know, if you fill up a whole block of with houses that are just for disabled people, I mean, is that integration? I mean, is that having access to people that aren't disabled? I also want to note that the 25% cap that has been referred to is not an arbitrary number, or it may be arbitrary, but it's in a federal statute. In 2010, the Frank Melville Housing and Restoration Act was passed, and it provides funding both for rental assistance and for the development of multifamily communities. And the 25% cap on the percentage of people with disabilities living in those communities is in that statute. Now, that statute doesn't necessarily apply unless you receive Program 811 monies, and monies under that statute. But nonetheless, that's an example of this push-pull. So I think it makes the most sense to wait and see how these issues develop, both at DHS, at CMS, the Department of Justice, and its Olmstead enforcement, and even the Olmstead plan, which is not final. It's being modified as we speak, and it will be reviewed by Judge Jonathan Frank in the federal court. So I think there are too many pieces moving too quickly to make a decision that everybody will be happy with. So with that, I'm happy to take questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Bell. And so having not seen anybody else in the audience who wanted to testify, I'm ready to move to questions. And I have Representative Abler on the list.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have two questions, one for Mr. Bell and then one for Ms. Bartolik. Mr. Bell, do you like carrots?
I'm sorry?
Oh, do you like carrots? Isn't that one of your joke song things?
I've been told it's good for vision. Oh.
So if Ms. Bartolik could come down, Madam Chair, I'd have one question for her. Madam Chair, I'm probably aware that this is taking up more time than you had expected, but this is a really important topic.
Well,
and
Representative Baker, we knew it was going to be a lot of time.
So, and I realize the department hasn't got a position for or against, but is this bill going in the direction you think you have to be in? And obviously we have more than 90 days, which was the original fear that we had. So so there's two questions there, I guess.
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair and Representative, the coalition has thought through many of the issues in trying to put together criteria that should be considered to look at if there was choice or if there is direction. They have started working their way through some of the issues we will have to work through with stakeholders.
Madam Chair, should this bill, so we there was a concern we had 90 days. That has gone away. So you have 5 years, and so that's...
Madam Chair.
Ms. Bartolik.
Representative Abler, the 90 days, in true bureaucracy language here, if we want CMS to do anything for us and we submit anything to them, we will have to give them a plan within 90 days of how we're going to come into compliance before they will consider our amendments. And so that is one, and then we will have, our plan can then say how within 5 years of the enactment of the rule we will be in compliance.
Okay, thanks. Okay. And so just one thing else, and so I have a lot more questions. I'll just limit them severely. So if this bill, with whatever amendments that are offered yet, becomes law, is that something we can do in the meantime that's appropriate, or should we do nothing in the meantime?
Oh, loaded question. Ms. Bartolik.
That's just one question.
Madam Chair, we are going to be developing our plan on what we're going to do and going forward in order to look forward with this. And if this is passed, we will implement that. And if our final plan has some changes, we would look next year to the legislature to make those changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Other members? All right. We have an amendment. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And just while Ms. Bartolik, I was going to catch Ms. Bartolik before she left. Sorry. Assistant Commissioner Bartolik, the other thing that I think plays into this, just so we have full background, is the how does the plan that you just described fit with the Olmstead, the U.S. Supreme Court Olmstead decision? Those of us on finance are dealing with a couple $1 million request related, or what's over $1 million, I know, request related to a lawsuit related to that. And if we do this plan, then do we have, and it's approved, is that kind of our protection against further Olmstead lawsuits? Olmstead, and maybe you should briefly explain that Olmstead is about community integration, et cetera. But I'm just wondering, I'm not quite sure how the plan and Olmstead work together.
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, the Olmstead plan is, the Olmstead decision was a Supreme Court decision in the end of late 1990s that actually started talking about what does integration and what's a state responsibility to afford people the opportunity to live in integrated settings. So, and it's being monitored and implemented through the Department of Justice. So there is a lot of action on this. And I do want to say that sometimes the Department of Justice takes actions against states, even though CMS has approved their use of federal fund in a certain way. So it isn't meaning just because CMS says it's okay that the Department of Justice will say something is in compliance with Olmstead. Minnesota has developed an Olmstead plan. As Mr. Bell said, we're in the process of continually monitoring it. And that plan is really the place for us to talk about our vision and steps we're going to take to try to assure people are fully integrated and have opportunities in the community. I think you're asking a question I don't know the answer to yet. How well will our plan support the Olmstead? It has to support Olmstead. Exactly what it looks like to comply with Olmstead is something that we will need to work through with stakeholders, and ultimately we have a federal judge who's involved who will also weigh in to the extent that it complies.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bartok. Members, I'd like to sort of begin to finish up with this bill, if we could. So, Representative Loeffler, I have an amendment here, and I...
And that's... Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendment.
Okay.
And I'll have to say, just since the bill was put up for hearing, I have been meeting with various people who've been involved on this from all perspectives over the last 24 hours, but the amendment actually got printed fairly soon. And so my apologies to everyone. This will go to Finance Committee and can continue to have some discussion. And let me just first explain the amendment. The first provisions underlines 1.2 to 1.3. Provides a basis on which I think we can get a fiscal note on this. That it provides that for this first year, the 2015 process, that we would have up to 5 exceptions granted for programs serving up to 150 individuals. If we get a fiscal, and I conferred with Ms. Bartolik, and she said this would really make it possible for them to do a fiscal note if this, you know, and the people advocating for this can argue if it should be, in their perspective, 10 and 300 people or, you know, whatever, but we'll at least have a basis going into the Finance Committee for putting together a projection so that we can fit within our budget targets. And I should say, I do support an exception process, and I appreciate people working hard on this. I think that some of the providers that have been working on this have an excellent model of serving some populations for whom this is a good answer and a good choice. At the same time, I do think, we have been at risk of circumstances where, for example, in the Kinets Committee, we're confronting Andrew House, which has 200 people in one facility serving people with mental health issues. It doesn't qualify for medical assistance, and we always want to maximize our ability to get that. So I think this will just enable us to get a fiscal note, and the Finance Committee can deal with whether or not these are the right numbers. I don't have a stance on what those numbers are or should be at this point, but I do think we need to get a fiscal note we can work with. The second part on lines 1.4 to 1.6 addresses the issue that was brought up by several of the advocates with disabilities, and in talking with the people who are proponents of this bill, they felt that this was their intent. Under the Hillman Community-Based Waiver Program, you have a choice of your vendor, and I talked with Mr. Peterson, who's the head of the coalition, and he said in his circumstance, that's what they do. For example, if you have someone who's of a Somali background and wants a provider who will provide Somali diet type meals on wheels, they already accommodate that. This just says that they will have the opportunity to select a vendor if for some reason the vendor provided by the developer isn't able to meet their unique needs. It might be a language translation issue if you had someone who didn't speak English adequately, that sort of thing. So this just says that the client can choose the vendor, retains that choice. One of the things I noted that it just doesn't, in the application, it doesn't ever say or ask for the characteristics of the population that are to be served. And while you might assume that that should be there, it just didn't say it. So is this going to be a place for people with mental health issues or developmental disability issues, for people who are blind, people who are HIV positive? I think that's important. And then explains that under line 3.6 that they should address the availability of options for that specific population. So if you're applying for housing for people with mental illness, you don't have to talk about what is the options for people with other types of disabilities. There is a public process, but it just says that they should provide in the bill that there should be a 14-day comment period, which I believe in the author's amendment changed to a longer period of time, but just that they should notify the city, county, and the community of the availability of that comment period so people are informed. And the last item is we typically, they have a provision in the bill right now that says if you are approved. So you've gotten your exception, you've built your, you know, 30-unit apartment building, whatever it is, and you've got it running, and you decide to make a material change, the bill provides that after the fact, 60 days after the fact, you have to notify DHS that you made this change. And that is not our tradition, that if you got this exception, it seems that you should ask in advance. And I'm told by some of the people who have been working on it that they have no problem with having to ask in advance. Like if you designed it for one population and the needs or the demand isn't there anymore and you want to switch to a different one. For example, if you were serving people who are HIV positive and we came up with the magic miracle cure for that and you wanted to convert that to serving people with some other population need, you could do that. You just have to get the Department of Human Services to advance to approve it in advance. So that's my intention, and this is not to in any way derail this moving forward, but to help us in getting a fiscal note that we can work with and clarifying some of the process things to be more standard with what we do.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I'm going to go to Representative Babler, take a couple questions from members here, and then we'll let Representative Dean comment, and then I hope we're going to get to a vote here pretty quickly. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I like most of this amendment, and I was going to move to divide it between lines 1-3 and 1-4. And eventually, I'd like to vote on the second part first.
Okay, Representative Abler moves to divide the amendment between lines 1.3 and 1.4 and wants to vote on the first part first. So we will.
Madam Chair, I'll explain if I can.
Okay,
then I'll turn it
go
back
ahead,
to the
Representative
author.
Babler. Why don't you explain that?
And the author of the amendment, I think, I actually think this really gets after the intent. And there's a lot of language here, but I think it's all really thoughtful, and it's what we all want to do while we still give flexibility. I think the five only thing, even if it's a fiscal note purpose, looks like a killer kind of a thing, and it's gonna. There's even 8 congressional districts. You can't have one per major area. So, I think that for this is going to go to finance anyway. But I think if the intent of the committee is that as many of these as can qualify that are reasonable to get done, that are the quality that we have here, that would tell us that. And so, that's my point. So I really like the text below, and I really don't like the five. So. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Babler. Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair and members, again, I support the division and I support everything starting with line 1.4, but the lines 1.2 and 1.3 relate to the fiscal note, and I think that's something that ought to be decided in the fiscal finance committee. So I would urge the members to vote for lines 1.4 to 1.18, but vote no on lines 1.2 and 1.3.
Okay, so Representative Huntley, we're on the second part first, so you're urging a yes vote on the second part, and if I got it right, a no vote on the first part. Okay. So members, to the second part of the amendment, so other members, committee members, want to comment or ask about the second part of the amendment? Okay, Representative Dean to the second part.
Well, I would just, you know, be in support of what Representative Abler's proposed on the division, and I've spoken with the advocates that, as I mentioned, have been working over the past 8 months, and 1.4 through 1.18, they seem as amenable, because clearly their intention is to do these types of things through the process.
All right, members, and as I understand the rules, we don't need, there's no vote on dividing, so the division is done. So we're voting first on the second half on lines 1.4 and on, and so I think we've had enough discussion on that. Committee's ready to vote on the second part. So all in favor of adopting line 1.4 to 1.18, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. So that motion is adopted, and then we're on the 1.1 to 1.3. Is there a discussion to that? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I do think this, and if we could, if we need to, we could have Ms. Bartola come up, but this does actually give us a basis. Otherwise, they can potentially assume that there will be 2,000 people that will be served into this exception process, because it doesn't have any caps or limits or anything else. And I would also like to remind people that the testimony that we heard from people who actually do have disabilities or family members with disabilities is that they're worried that this will become the only choice. And that's potentially a risk if we overbuild simply because we have had a moratorium on corporate foster care, that's the shift staff foster care, for many, many years. And so there has been no choice in the smaller scale properties because we have limited their ability to grow. And it just seems to me that we ought to, for the first year, get a good fiscal note so we know what the obligations are, but we also maintain that some perspective on making sure that there are choices along the whole continuum, which the consortium has assured me was always their intent, was not to ever have large be the common denominator of every community, but an option for those for whom it's appropriate.
Okay, Representative Dean, to the part.
Madam Chair, folks are willing to work with the department to determine what that number is. I'm not so sure that five is a good number, and there has been some concerns by some individual that if we do adopt something that says 150 individuals, that it's going to push individuals to then develop to 150 units, where the appropriate setting might not be 150 units. And as Representative Loeffler mentioned, that this is for 1 year, but as I interpret the language with inserting this, it would actually put a limit of a cap of 5 years forever. So if her intent was to do that, this amendment doesn't succeed in doing that. And again, I think the advocates are more than willing to sit down with the department as well as even Representative Loeffler to discuss this further before it comes up in the Finance Committee.
All right. Thank you, Representative Dean. I think we're ready to vote on the first part of the amendment then. All those in favor of the first part of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
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 The motion does not prevail. So we have adopted the second part of the amendment. So members, unless there are other questions or comments to the bill as amended, I think we're ready to vote on the bill. So Representative Abler is going to renew his motion that House File 1992 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. House File 1479, Representative Isaacson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
For Representative Isaacson, I'm going to move that House File 1479 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And there's a DE1 amendment. I will move that as well to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to have it discussed. All those in favor of the DE1-1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. I can see you're all enthusiastic and ready to go. So, okay. Welcome, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I'm just really grateful to have the opportunity to talk to you folks today. This has been a little bit of a labor of love for me, this bill has, as I've learned way more about HHS than I ever anticipated I would. But I've received excellent advice and leadership from the chair, and that's helped me kind of hone this bill into what I think is a shape ready for you guys. And so what I'd like to do is just walk you through the simple and then the maybe slightly more complex aspect of this, and I have a couple testifiers that will give us some history and context for this as well. Basically, what I'm trying to do at the end of the day with this bill is provide opportunity for interventions for folks that are on medical assistance in looking at how we provide the type of asthma care that we do. What we have is a lot of situations where people are using the emergency room as their main way of managing their asthma, and for especially young children in poorer families. And what we have here is a model put together not only by the ALA, but other cities that have used it, that has really given us a chance to not only help them have better quality of lives, increase them on the time that they're in school, but also, and perhaps really important to members of this committee and the next one, the amount of money that's been saved has been phenomenal for a small investment. You know, $600 invested, thousands of dollars saved by DHS and emergency room visits we haven't had to go on. So that's kind of the quick version. Now I'll be a little bit more in depth. You know, what we're looking at doing is the following things. And I have it listed here, reimburse certified asthma educators and healthy home specialists to provide in-home asthma interventions and asthma education, cover allergen-reducing products for asthma triggers identified during a home assessment or in-home asthma intervention, cover modified services needed to reduce asthma triggers such as mold and pest control, expand child and teen checkup services as well as early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatments in non-clinical settings, and revise provider-based to include certified asthma educators. Coordinate with medical health homes and home health care homes to provide and coordinate care for people with chronic conditions like asthma, and reimburse in-clinic education provided by certified asthma educators. What we're finding, and I think you're going to hear here, is that when we take the steps to provide an ability to stop the triggers that cause asthma attacks to happen, especially in homes that really don't have what they need or aren't able to purchase it for themselves, we end up saving ourselves a ton of money in time not spent in the emergency room. And I know you can all appreciate how difficult it is to quantify in a fiscal note all the money we save by stopping something from happening. And I know that's tough to explain, but we do have a little bit of numbers on that. But I would much rather really get into the number game if we're so lucky as we pass on to finance to really have that discussion there. But we'll touch on that today. First, I want to introduce Jill. She's with the American Lung Association, and she can start us down the path on this bill.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. I'm Jill Hines Nesvold. I serve as the Director of Respiratory Health for the American Lung Association of the Upper Midwest. Thank you for allowing us here. 12 years ago, the American Lung Association Minnesota started to intensely improve asthma care for children in Minnesota through a 7-year grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We call this the Partners for Asthma Action. Asthma care in our state has greatly improved over this time span. However, there are still some missing holes. The goal of the Enhancing Asthma Care Services Bill is to fill in these missing pieces for medical assistance members. One of the missing pieces is in-home asthma education and reducing asthma triggers in the home. Part of the Partners for Asthma Action Project worked on providing in-home asthma education and also identifying and reducing asthma triggers found in the home, such as dust mites, molds, strong odors, pets, and pests, such as rodents and cockroaches. The American Lung Association of Minnesota funded and conducted an in-home assessment and education of 255 children with poorly managed asthma. We provided the remediations to reduce those asthma triggers in the home, and we also provided in-home asthma education. We conducted evaluation consisting of baseline, 3, and 12-month post-intervention follow-up. What we found was amazing. What we found was statistically significant. In 3 months, we were able to statistically significantly reduce daytime symptoms, nighttime symptoms, and improve the function of those kids. So they were in the emergency department less, they were hospitalized less, they were in school ready to learn more often. Equally important, their parents weren't at home with them when the kids were in school, but rather the parents were able to go to work, and we were able to increase the controller medications that reduce the inflammation of asthma. This program cost the American Lung Association about $320 in professional fees per child and $300 per child in modification costs. We also partnered with Medica Health Plans in our evaluation to look at these children that were their members. There were 48 of their members. And what we found, for every dollar the American Lung Association put into the in-home education and environmental improvements, Medica saved $2.19. I'm going to repeat that once more. For every dollar the American Lung Association put in, we saved $2.19. We have since replicated this model in Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Wisconsin, but all of these programs are grant funded. The American Lung Association is not the only group that has proven this. The City of Minneapolis Environmental Action for Children's Health provided services to over 500 children with poorly managed asthma, and they estimate a cost savings of $7.6 million. The Minnesota Department of Health has a reducing asthma for reducing environmental triggers for children with asthma, and this is a statewide initiative. And for every child, they have estimated a savings of $1,960 in the 12 months after the intervention. Time and time again in Minnesota and across the country, there has been proven evidence that this works. We're able to save money for these children with poorly managed asthma. Based on this evidence, we hope that the committee will pass the Enhancing Asthma Care Services Bill so that community-based interventions are available for children across the state of Minnesota. This bill would target those children most at need across the state of Minnesota and be of great benefit to them as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And we have another testifier.
Yep, Dr. Gail Brotman.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of this Enhanced Asthma Care Services Bill. My name is Dr. Gail Brotman, and I am the Director of Pediatric Pulmonary Medicine at Hennepin County Medical Center. I have been working there for over 20 years, and the majority of my practice includes seeing patients with asthma. You have heard about the environmental asthma management interventions and the return on investments and cost savings, but I would like to put a face on this asthma bill and talk to you about some very basic challenges that occur when treating patients with asthma. Shalexis is one of my patients who has a history of multiple hospital admissions for asthma, including spending time in the pediatric intensive care unit on a ventilator when she stopped breathing because of her asthma. We made a referral to her home for a home environmental evaluation and asthma education for her mother, and the asthma educator found multiple triggers in her home, including feather pillows, cigarette smoke exposure, despite the fact that her mom vehemently denied that anybody smoked in her home, and some mold in the bathroom. The asthma educator also found that her asthma controller inhaler was empty and her NEB machine was broken. There were multiple interventions done over a long period of time, and in the last year, I'm pleased to say that she had one emergency department visit and has missed no school. During the course of a different home assessment visit, the mother described to an asthma educator that her daughter with asthma had the chore of sweeping a dusty floor with a broom. This was a new chore because they did not have a vacuum, and in doing this chore, this contributed to her poorly controlled asthma. I will tell you right now, this is something that would have never come up in a conversation at an asthma visit in the clinic. You may think that these environmental issues apply only to inner city families, but there are similar challenges in the homes of asthma patients throughout the entire state. The point of these stories is that I, as a physician, can prescribe medications and give instructions for their use, but when people are exposed to powerful asthma triggers all of the time at home, this works against all of these expensive medications. And I will tell you that for one asthma controller medication, the going rate is somewhere between $150 and $200 per inhaler per month. It is not only important to identify the asthma triggers in the home, but to be able to do something to minimize their impact in order to improve asthma control. Education is the key to any chronic disease management. There are different places to deliver this education, though it is typically done in the clinic or hospital setting. While this works for some families, many patients and providers have limited time in an office visit, or families cannot take time off of work for an extra visit to meet with the asthma educator. During home visits, asthma educators not only make assessments of asthma triggers, they promote healthy lifestyle changes such as understanding the importance of using a vacuum or not using harsh cleaning products, which could act as an asthma trigger. This work is also difficult to do in a clinic setting. Many inhalers look the same, so people get confused as to which inhaler to use when. Home asthma educators check on medication use and help families organize medications and the multiple inhalers many patients use. This enhanced asthma care services bill will help to fill these significant gaps in asthma care. Evaluation of three home environmental and educational interventions completed here in Minnesota, as Jill mentioned, show the greatest results in improving patient care, including keeping children out of the hospital and emergency room, helping them to take their controller medication, and keeping them in school, as well as having a positive return on investment. Cost considerations are important in any piece of legislation. However, even if this program broke even, it would be a cost-effective way to improve the quality of life for our children with asthma in Minnesota. Thank you very much for your consideration of this important piece of legislation.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Brotman, for being here today. And are there questions from members? Representative Loeffler, and we'd like to really get there pretty quickly. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Brotman, since most of these people are on medical assistance, which is through statewide through a prepaid medical assistance program with the managed care entities, and what you're proposing is very similar to what the response has been to lead issues as well. Are you finding that prepaid medical assistance is not generally covering this right now? Because I know they do refer people to, you know, visiting nurses and other home services, or is this, that's the problem we're trying to address?
Ms. Hines?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. In response to that, Dr. Brockman asked me to answer it. Currently, a home visit by a public health nurse would be reimbursed, but reimbursement for an asthma educator, which is a healthcare professional with extensive above and beyond training, proven that they have a knowledge base in asthma, is not currently covered. In addition, any of the interventions to reduce the environmental triggers specific to that individual with poorly managed asthma are not covered.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions? All right, not seeing any. So I'm going to renew my motion that House Bill 14.
I'm sorry.
Representative Albright, go ahead.
I don't know who wants to answer this, but are we not fulfilling this program now? Is this a new program?
Madam Chair?
Right, Representative Eisen.
What they've been doing in the past is working through grants, and it's been nonprofit work that's been doing this side of it. And what we're saying is that because it's really the model, in my mind, of how we, a little bit of prevention now saves us from spending a lot on a cure later.
I just have one. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the document that was in our packet, and I don't know who prepared this, but I'm intrigued by the, on page 2, where it compares the cost versus the savings or ROI. And I'm just wondering if maybe for the sake of the members, you might just elaborate on the ROI. Some folks might not be entirely versant in what that means or how to read that grid.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to respond to that. I think the, I'm sorry, I can't see your name tag. Representative Albright. Regarding the ROI, or return on investment, it is on in your packet on page 2 in the table number 1. There we provided the cost savings estimates for the three programs that have shown to be highly effective here in the state of Minnesota. The third row there is the environmental improvements for children with asthma funded by the American Lung Association in Minnesota. What we were able to do based on our evaluation is partner with Medica Health Plans. And what we found is a cost savings. For every dollar that the American Lung Association put into the program, Medica Health Plans saved $2.19 in all-cause health care costs for those members.
Okay. All right. Not seeing any other questions. Okay. Then I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1479 be re-referred as amended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next is going to be House File 2556, Representative Newton.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Representative Newton. I'll move House File 2556 to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, House File 2556 is a part of two bills that we have, one dealing with the Department of Veterans Affairs, this one dealing with Health and Human Services. And it's as a result of the Select Committee on Veterans Housing that met over the summer. Representative Abler was a member of that committee. These were recommendations that went forward unanimously to the Speaker. What this bill does, very simply, is adds to the list of exceptions to the moratorium veterans foster home care and veterans group residential housing. So we're not asking for anything special. The funding for these comes out of a different fund, and we're just asking that these exceptions be made.
Are there any questions? There are no testifiers, is that correct?
I have no testifiers, no ma'am.
Are there questions from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify either for or against the bill?
A good bill, Madam Chair.
Seeing none, I'll renew my motion for House File 2556 be re-referred as to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sorry. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried. House File 2314, Representative Fabian. Okay. We'll move to House File 3059, Representative Norton. Non-emergency medical transportation services provisions modified. Welcome to the committee, Representative Norton. I'll move House File 3059 be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Policy. And you have an A1 amendment, Representative Norton?
Yes, we do.
All right, I will move A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape which the author would like to present it. Are there any questions on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Norton.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. We have before you a long incoming piece of legislation. This body several years ago put together a committee, 2.5 years ago, I think Representative McDonald and others helped start this process. I have been the appointee from the House, and Kathy Sharon, Senator Sharon, has been the appointee from the Senate. Representative Fritz helped with this for some time, and this is an issue that's been around the legislature for many, many years. Some of you will remember it. If you're newer, you'll soon know more than you probably want to. But non-emergency medical transportation is a federal requirement that transportation be provided to folks on MA and to get to their medical appointments. So it's a federal program that the state runs. We have in the past had an ATS and an STS program, access transportation and special transportation. There have been issues with the implementation. There has been an audit report that is Representative McDonald's bill was in response to the auditor's report. The committee that has been meeting has been large and vocal. And sitting next to me is Sue Abderholden, who chaired this fund committee for several years, as well as we've had a department person that was contracted to help us as well work through the process. So we have, I'm just going to highlight quickly a couple of the changes, and I'm just going to turn it over to her as the chair. She's walked through this. As I said, this is a very tenuous agreement, and I think we have all... We have all agreed that it may not be perfect, but we're all willing to support, and no one is going to testify against. And I think, as I said, it's tenuous, but I think we're finally there. So along with changing the STS and ATS programs, we are not going to have modes of transportation that will be determined. We have developed a process in the committee to determine the level of need and a script that will be used, so everyone will be treated the same, and that's being handled, I think, somewhat outside the legislation. We are trying to push more folks on public transportation and volunteers and volunteer rides by we actually looked at other states and found out that Minnesota had far more at the time ATS and STS provided rides than most other states. They did a lot more public transportation, they did a lot more transit, they did a lot more volunteer, and we just simply weren't doing that. We had a program that was growing and growing and becoming quite costly and unwieldy. So we're through this script process, we're going to be pushing people back into the what the federal law says, which is the most appropriate but least costly method of transportation. We are in this legislation awaiting a web-based tool, so you will see some of it implemented immediately, as Sue Abderholden will talk about in a little bit, and some of it being pushed out to future years, because we as a committee do believe that a web-based tool will solve many, many of our problems, but the department is not quite there yet, so you'll see that in here. We are going to assure that no matter what vehicle persons take for their ride to their doctor appointment, it is going to be a safe vehicle, and it will have gone through a certification process, and in the legislation we have, I think, finally come to some language that will allow the department to be able to do that through fees and over in a process that they'll be able to manage as well. So it's been a long and painful process, but I think we have something now that will move us in the right direction, and I'm going to have Sue Abderholden, the chair of our committee, talk more, and she'll answer every question that you have. I'll help.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota and Chair of the NEMT Advisory Committee. And I really want to say that what you have before you is nothing short of a miracle. I've worked on a lot of contentious, difficult issues over the past 30 years, and I have to say that this was one of the most difficult tasks ever put before me. You do just have a lot of stakeholders who just have very different perspectives. I want to be sure that you know that and really understand that this bill reflects a very fragile and carefully worded compromise, and that you resist any temptation to change anything in it. One of the things I want to say is that we spent a lot of time actually developing a policy manual to really handle some of just the process of how this is going to work. In the bill, what you really have is we have responded to a lot of the OLA's reports, suggestions. We have created a single administrative structure for fee-for-service. I want to point that out. And it will be housed within the counties who currently administer what we call ATS. However, in order to make this work for the providers, we need to have technology available statewide. So we need a web-based system to facilitate the enrollment process, eligibility determination, assigning the modes, and reconciling trip information with claiming. There are systems out there. We are not starting from scratch. They just aren't available statewide. So we are providing the two-year delay of the single administrative structure until this can be built. All the providers of NEMT, except obviously public transportation and volunteer not for hire, will have to now meet NEMT vehicle and driver requirements. This will provide some assurances that some of our most vulnerable children and adults are being transported in safe vehicles with good drivers. A fee would cover the cost of inspecting these new vehicles, and a new rule would also have to be developed. During this interim period, the counties will continue to administer the client volunteer unassisted and part of the assisted, with the state remaining doing the remaining ones. We're still working on some language to make sure that we can do that during the two-year period. You will note that the payment is by mode, not by the type of vehicle used, and we do provide an increase in the mileage rate for clients and volunteers in order to encourage these very inexpensive modes. Volunteer is up to 200%, and it's raised to address the concerns with no load miles, but I want to point out that it's up to, because some volunteers may not want to take that amount, because you have to count as income any payment rate above what the IRS states, and so some people may not want to do that. We did also put in a way to adjust the rates when gas prices go up for providers, and it would, and we also increased their rates by eliminating the previous 4.5% reduction. The advisory committee would continue so that we can add to the policy manual and address any issues that arise. We would meet at least quarterly, and the membership has changed slightly to have an almost equal number of providers, counties, and advocates. While I have joked that this was perhaps the worst committee I ever chaired, I also want to say that it has some of the most passionate people around transportation. One thing I do want to mention is with the modes, and somehow I've lost that page, is that we did add one mode to it. We'll rename them too. So you will have the you'll have the typical modes in terms of, you know, the volunteer and then, you know, the client, public transport, and then you have unassisted, where they don't need help any at all, and assisted, and a new mode is protected transport. So this is the one thing that I got out of the committee. And for many years, we have talked about people with a serious mental illness being transported in the back of a police car, you know, with handcuffs, or in an ambulance where they're tied down. Both very expensive, frankly, to do. And so we would have this new protected mode, which is actually being carried out in three counties right now, and this would be paid for under Medicaid. So it would be kind of like an unmarked police car, but, you know, you wouldn't be able to get out because the locks would be there and things like that, but it would be a much more dignified way to travel when someone is going perhaps from home to the hospital. So I just wanted to mention that. Finally, I just want to say that, as Representative Norton said, this is not a perfect solution. I don't think you can get one on this issue. Not everyone is thrilled, but it is workable. It's good for the clients. It addresses many of the concerns, and most importantly, it moves us forward. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. I guess to either one of the Representative Norton or the testifier, I'm just looking at this letter in the packet from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and specifically the second to last paragraph that says, we are concerned that HF 3059 will move the state in the wrong direction by making it more difficult to use brokerage services in the NMET program. We are concerned that the result will be less oversight and higher cost. And before that, they gave us several examples of other states that actually realize savings. And so what, you know, I know any bill has to, with a lot of different stakeholders, has to have some compromise, but can you respond to their concerns?
Madam Chair. Well, I can't tell you how deeply disappointed I was to see this. We have been meeting for 2.5 years. The chamber has never approached any of us about any of these issues. So I was really disappointed that this was their mode of handling this. The audit report was studied these issues, and they found no proof, if you will, that this is the case. So as you heard, this is not a perfect solution, but it is the solution that the advocates, the providers, everybody that was at the table, including the legislatures, has determined is the very best method moving forward. And we'll acknowledge it's not perfect, but our whole goal is to drive costs down, to be fair to the providers, as well as certainly make sure clients are safe. And we've done the very best job we can. And I don't know if Sue Abderholden would like to respond further. I was really shocked to see this show up in packets. And I didn't hand it out, but I do have a letter from the Minnesota Hospital Association, and perhaps they'd like to testify in support of what we're doing. So, you know, I have that as well.
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, what I'd like to say is that if you had sat through all of these meetings, you would understand that just saying, oh, just using a broker for everything is the easiest way to do it, because it's not. And then, there are good things and bad things about every system that you put forward. But we've had a lot of discussion about the use of brokers. The counties will be able to continue to do that, and they're much closer to it. I think just think that there truly, after all this time, to think that there is a silver bullet out there on this issue, there is not.
Okay. Representative Bunegas, thank you. Representative Abler, I just want to note the time.
Yeah, thanks, and I'm aware. It's interesting, a bill that really nobody likes, but you can't change it because it's such a tenuous dislike that people will like it less if you fix it. I just want to offer one comment. On page 10 about the Department of Transportation and the DHS are going to develop a web-based single administrative structure and assessment tool. Can we just have them go buy one that works? We haven't done real well. We tried Health Match, and I don't know if DOT is any better at their technology than we are. I'm just being serious. I didn't even go into the other rest of the joke about other websites we've not done well at.
I'm glad
Minnesota Forever insists on making up its own stuff, and sometimes that's foolish. And I just, as you move along, could you see if like Georgia has figured this out and like pay them any amount of money? And just because, thank you.
Any?
Pretty much.
Thank you. Thank you.
It'll still be cheaper. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I would just say there are tools out there already. Some of our current providers have them. Some of the brokers have them. The department has been working with SmartLink in Carver and Scott County. They're very thrilled with that. And when our committee saw that presentation, they were sold. And in fact, we kind of got on this bandwagon that we were ready to put it in law and do it tomorrow. And then the department said, wait a minute, we're not ready to make a choice about that. Yes, there are some in place. We could choose those. We're going to, as a committee, look at all the options and some pre-packaged ones as well as some new ones.
Representative Huntley.
I had the same question about why would you ban a broker from being used? And that's on page 7, lines 7.3 to 7.7. Seems to me that reduces the ability to have competition, and it reduces what it does is protect those providers that currently do not have any competition. And some of those providers are not very good. Some of them have been sued by the state for overbilling for miles they never delivered. And I just think that having a option to have a broker in there would make more competition and make some of these poor providers of transportation services improve their own acts.
Madam Chair.
Sorry. Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Huntley, in the amendment, and this is actually currently the case on the state level, you're just wanting to separate who does the level of need and who does the dispatching of the vehicles. And that actually was brought, several years ago by advocates, too. So during this two-year period, that will stay in place, and then when we go to the single administrative structure, then it's really up to the counties or groups of counties in terms of what they do.
Representative Huntley, are you okay?
No, I made my point as much as I can.
Given the time, we're going to need to recess. We have a few more questions, and we'd like you to hold those until this evening. We'll recess until 6 p.m. tonight, room 10. We are in recess.
Okay. All right, so I know members are going to drift in, but I know that there are other committees running, and people are going to have to be in a lot of different places, so I'd like to get us started anyway. And I understand that even though I was in another committee at the time, that Representative Norton was in the middle of answering a question from Representative Huntley at the time that the committee was recessed. So unfortunately, he's not going to be here this evening, but if you want to go ahead and finish your answer, Representative Norton, that would be just great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. He had asked a question about the brokering in Section 4. And so for the committee's understanding, we are not changing current law. Brokering has been prohibited for a number of years now. We're not changing that. Brokering, it was quite a controversial issue a number of years ago. You should know that it was done, this prohibition was put in place with a bipartisan effort. And it actually had restricted access for local businesses to the clients that they needed to serve. The brokering had allowed one company to pick winners and losers. Unfortunately, many of our providers, some of them came to testify and found out recently or fairly shortly after they had testified that their contract was dissolved. It ended up becoming very uncomfortable for local providers across the state who were then afraid to speak up about the issues that we've been dealing with for many, many years. So this brokering has been in place. We're not changing it. It's going to stay in place. And, in fact, as we move to a single administrative structure by the counties could then move ahead and do that brokering at a county level. We're just restricting it the state. And the other reason is we want patients, clients to choose the providers they want. If they're all registered, they're all certified, they're all well-known, they should be able to access who they want. And so we're trying to support a client-centered approach as well.
Okay. Are there other questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that you know in the bill is that DHS, the commissioner, is going to be taking responsibility for the accumulation of information, and I'm just wondering, I don't know that they've got
Representative Albright, we're having trouble understanding you. I think you're not talking into the mic.
I'm talking down. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
Thank you.
The question goes to DHS in terms of the tracking of the data that's being collected, and I'm just wondering how they intend to collect that going forward. Seems to be a little bit of a weakness in terms of their data collection on other issues, so I'm just wondering how that's going to work on this program.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Apter-Holden.
If I can answer that question. So it'll be the counties actually pulling together the data and sending it to the state, because you're right, no one looks at it at the state, which is why we really wanted to have the counties be in control. And when we create this web-based system, they're going to be matching up the trips and the billing and things like that, which I think will be helpful. And then they'll just provide to the state kind of the summary data about appeals, complaints, no-shows, canceled trips, and number of trips by mode. So we'll be able to actually look at it more carefully than we can now.
Representative Albright.
This would be to the author. Could there be an explanation for me just in terms of what it means to be a broker?
Representative Norton.
This can be answered in a couple ways. The state of Minnesota, a number of years ago, had counties managing this system. At one time, they decided, and it was before my time in the legislature, that hiring one company to determine level of need and broker the rides, call the rides, that they would do it as a statewide system. They put that system in place. Actually, as a result of that, and the STS and ATS programs growing, that program, I think, doubled or tripled in a very short period of time and grew. We put this prohibition in place, and what happens now is the state contracts with a company to determine level of need. And then we have prohibited the brokering of rides. So when we talk about brokering, some people call it brokering the level of need, but it's really a contract to determine the level of need that's done. And in the old days, during this interim, when we had the statewide broker, they actually arranged the rides for every client. So that's what brokering used to be. Now there is one consortium of counties, I believe, that has hired a company to do the brokering for their, I don't know if it's a full seven counties, but some of the metro area, and we don't broker rides any longer as a state system, as I understand, if I'm answering this correctly. And Ms. Abderholden may want to talk about, as we're moving forward, if there will be differences moving ahead, but we're going to move to a more county-based system, partly for accountability. That's one of the reasons we're doing that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that the Office of Legislative Auditor made critique of this program in the past, and I've read over their report, and I'm just wondering if either the author or the testifier would make remark to some of the findings in his report.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. I do not have the auditor's report with me. That was actually the impetus for this whole committee. In fact, many of us that serve on that committee were the ones that requested the audit. So we requested the audit. We took the results. Representative McDonald was in the majority at the time, and he worked with somebody has it with them. I didn't have it in my folder. So as the result, the committee was formed to hammer out the details into a more streamlined, transparent, and understandable system that was good not just for the clients, but also for the providers and the state. And we dealt with a number of issues over the last 2.5 years, but this result was a result of our request. This report was as a result of our request for more information and has guided our whole work.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for a frame of mind, I know that our staff works long hours, and in light of that, I stopped by establishment on Wabasha and picked up a thank you treat for the staff, so you can pass that around. And whatever's left, then the committee members can share. But it's just in recognition that sometimes we need to just thrill in the small treats every day.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Albright, for understanding who is really important around this place.
Amen.
Yes. Sure. Okay. Other questions from members? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going back to Representative Huntley's comment that this limits competition, but yet our local brokers are still involved. And I'm just a little foggy on that yet, if you can clear that fogginess up. Why is he, and he's not here. I wish he was. But he claims this is limiting competition, and that competition would actually, a competitive situation would be better. But
Representative Norton,
thank you.
I wish I could ask the question clearer, but no. I'm a little fogged up on it myself.
Well, yeah. It's a very foggy issue, Representative Grunhagen, and I think what we have put in place is actually going to provide better competition. All the providers that wish to participate and be a provider in the state will in the future go through a certification process with their vehicles and their drivers. They will be their vehicles will be inspected, and once they go through that process, they are eligible to provide rides. And in my mind, by making them all eligible to provide rides rather than having some other company pick winners and losers, you actually are motivated to do a better job, to provide good service for the constituents that you're, because if you do a good job and are pleasant and have a clean vehicle, they'll call you again. So in my mind, this actually provides a more robust market than a broker who picks and chooses winners and losers in the system.
What they used to say when I went to law school, they'd say the judge will pick his brother-in-law. If you don't decide who you want, that might be the case here. I don't know.
It is.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen, any other? Okay. Other questions, members? Okay. Not seeing any. And we have one other testifier, Laura Rhodes. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Rhodes, staff attorney in MnDOT's Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. Among other things, we work with limousine operators, motor carriers of passengers, and special transportation service providers to help improve the safety of their operations. We do this by implementing, administering, and enforcing Minnesota statutes and rules. I am here today not in opposition of this proposal, but instead to briefly explain how House File 3059 would potentially impact MnDOT's STS program and to let the author, Ms. Abderholden, and the legislature know that MnDOT is interested in working on language to create a program that MnDOT can successfully implement. The STS program has been in place since the late 70s, early 80s. Prior to the rules being written, there were lots of complaints about bad driver behavior. The rules were written with a very specific population in mind, the elderly and disabled. Since the adoption of the rules and an update to the rules in 2004, MnDOT has worked very hard to get the STS program to where it is today. Currently, we have 205 providers and 2,378 vehicles. That's in our STS program. The fiscal note for this bill is not complete, but very quickly I'd like to run through some of the numbers and rough estimates we anticipate using for the fiscal note.
Well, ma'am, I don't think that that really is within the jurisdiction of this committee, so I would rather not take time to do that. This bill is going to go to Transportation Policy and then probably to a Finance Committee.
Sure. Madam Chairman, would it be possible if I could run through briefly some of our concerns with the bill as it is currently written?
As they impact health and the delivery of health care to Minnesotans, absolutely. If they are something outside of that, then we should probably leave that for another committee. So.
Okay. All right. I guess I don't know that they impact health. They would potentially impact the STS program within MnDOT that does serve.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I promise I'll be brief.
Okay.
Lines 2.9 to 2.12 in the bill state that all NEMT providers must comply with the STS rules and operating standards. And our concern there is that there isn't clear language providing authority for MnDOT to be the authority, the agency responsible for enforcing compliance with the rules. The policy manual states that a new rule will be created by MnDOT specific to NEMT services, but the bill does not give us specific rulemaking authority or guidance in terms of what the rule should include. MnDOT is familiar with the safety aspect of an enforcement, but not necessarily the MA or level of need and mode determinations. And so to that end, we would hope for specific guidance from DHS and or the NEMT Advisory Committee to help us create rules that best serve this program. It would take approximately 6 months to hire and train new employees, and so we are concerned about the effective date of this bill. According to Minnesota Rules Chapter 8840, no vehicle may be used to provide special transportation services until it has been inspected. So depending on the number of new NEMT providers and vehicles, MnDOT would hope to have some sort of phase-in system or plan to inspect the new vehicles as to not create a backlog. Lines 10.31 to 10.33 state that the Commissioner of Transportation shall charge NEMT providers a fee to recover the actual costs of administering the provision in Subdivision 17C. MnDOT currently does not have enough information to determine what dollar amount would cover cost of administering the program. It would be difficult to determine that amount without knowing the number of providers or vehicles that would be part of the NEMT program. Lastly, in order for the proceeds of the provider fee to go to MnDOT, we believe there needs to be specific appropriation language regarding where the funds go and then language appropriating it back to MnDOT. The potential implications this bill has for the commercial vehicle operations section in MnDOT are complex, and we would prefer not to make a quick fix, as that may have unintended consequences or may cause confusion. We are optimistic about continuing to work with the author on changes to the bill and find language to make the regulation of NEMT providers successful and efficient. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Rhodes. And Representative Norton?
Yes. And we have had MnDOT representation on our committee all along. Ms. Rhodes came to the last meeting and shared some of these concerns. And so the Ms. Abderhold and others have been meeting, and we believe we have language that will work. It just is not has to be approved by all the members before it's put on, so we plan on doing that in transportation finance. So we think we've got that ironed out. We just weren't ready for the amendment tonight.
Right. Thank you, Representative Norton. And it is a rare day when we have somebody from MnDOT in this committee. So, you know, I trust that, you know, by sending this on to the committees that have jurisdiction over MnDOT and MnDOT's accounts, that there'll be plenty of opportunity. You know, this committee is dealing, as I said, with the health issue here, which is getting our people on our public programs to the providers who are going to provide the service for them.
Sure, and I very much appreciate your time, and I guess why we're here is because we believe that we want to make sure that the NEMT program can be as successful as our STS program, and that is directly related to helping people elderly and disabled for STS and people in the riders in NEMT get to their medical appointments.
Right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Okay. You have people on the list here. Okay. So, members, I don't see any other questions. So, I'm going to renew. Oh, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I wasn't sure if just the testifiers, but I have a question for the author.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Norton, I just a couple of questions, and I've read through the bill and trying to just get a handle. And I know you commented on in your introduction a bit about the OLA report, and I know I saw an updated a kind of amendment to the OLA report that I think we got in 2012. But I know we've talked about this over the past couple of years and the issues that were raised in that, and I'm just trying to get a handle on what's been addressed thus far, the caution just being the OLA report at that time was a bit critical of how DHS had overseen this program thus far. And in this bill, we're moving even more oversight into the hands of DHS, or a bit more of the okay, and I'll let you respond to that. But I guess my one question is just in terms of some of the issues with rulemaking procedures, some of the policies that the OLA recommended being put in place that are kind of laid out in their executive summary. And I'm just wondering, I know we don't have time for an in-length explanation, but some of the key things that have been addressed in the OLA report as we've moved forward and as we go through this major transition at this point with this program.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack. Actually, we've done really tried to address all of them. So we've created the single administrative structure so that it's on the county level and they can really monitor, you know, what's going on a lot more easily than the state. We actually, in our policy manual that we all worked on, addressed the length of time people are eligible so that it's 7 years unless things change. And we actually developed a phone script so that you can ask those kinds of questions when people call in. We actually, because we've created modes now instead of types of vehicles, and because we have the script that will direct people to the right place in the right mode, that addresses the special versus access. And again, looking at the eligibility policies, we did that as part of the policy manual, connected to the modes. One of the things that they brought up was the fact they weren't taking into account some of the symptoms of mental illness when they looked at the different modes. That is, a mental health professional can, you know, send that comment in, which we didn't have before. And then the biggest part was that DHS should identify, collect, and report key measures related to this. And because the counties will be reporting that data, it'll be easier for the state to actually monitor it. So we really kept this open a lot to make sure that we were addressing the concerns that were raised.
Representative Mack? Okay. All right. Are there any other testifiers, anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? All right. Not seeing anybody. So, and I just, before we have the vote, I just would like to thank and commend all the people on the task force, particularly, I guess, Ms. Abderholden, but I know that this has been a very difficult, long, intensive negotiation and very hard to get to agreement, and really appreciate that because, you know, we got a report. Somebody had to actually get down and work out the details, and a group of people did that, and we really appreciate it. So I'm going to renew the motion that House File 3059, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Policy. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you so very much.
All right. We have to Representative Fabian. Representative Fabian, House File 2314. I know they are. All right, let's see here. 14. All right. I will move that House File 2314 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And this is Representative Fabian. Welcome to the committee, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that motion. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. Some of you probably don't recognize my voice. I apologize for that. I'm trying out for the Oak Ridge Boys this weekend, so I'm practicing. I'm going to keep my comments short, obviously, but I do want to say thank you, first of all, to the committee for hearing this bill and the chair, obviously. I do want to say thanks to the Sanford Medical Center in Thief River Falls. They have sought us out to provide a service to the residents of Minnesota to expand mental health coverages and so forth in our area, which is very important. I think that everybody recognizes the fact that this is a very critical issue in the state of Minnesota. One of the reasons why I'm such a strong supporter of the bill is because in many cases, many of my constituents who need these services are traveling great distances away from Northwest Minnesota to get the care that they need. And one of the things that's important in terms of treating these illnesses is having family, friends, some sort of a support group nearby. And if we've got to go 250, 300 miles away for these services, it certainly makes it much more difficult to do that. So the bill is really quite simple. If you have the bill in front of you, this does address health care for Minnesotans, as the chair was mentioning earlier in some of her comments. And the bill is very simple. On page 5 of the bill, 5.7 and 5.8, notwithstanding section, a project for a 25-bed psychiatric hospital in the city of Thief River Falls. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to present Brian Carlson and Casey Johnson from Thief River Falls Sanford Medical Center to discuss more about the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Fabian. So who's first here? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to address the bill which is before you. My name is Brian Carlson. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Sanford Thief River Falls Medical Center. To my right is Casey Johnson. He is our Chief Financial Officer in Thief River as well. We did have several individuals lined up that were willing to come here and testify on our behalf as well, but in respect for the time constraints that the committee has, we opted not to bring them today. We did include, there's a handout that should be going around if it hasn't already. The last page of that handout does show the supporters that we have to this bill, and many of those were willing to come and testify today as well. Healthcare, as you know, many of us know, is at a precipice in many fronts today, not the least of which is the provision of behavioral health services, particularly in rural health communities. What I wanted to do today is just paint a quick backdrop of behavioral health services in northwestern Minnesota, what Thief River Falls currently provides, and what it is we're looking to be able to do with the advancement of this bill. Thief River Falls Hospital is a critical access hospital, and I'm sure many of the committee members have critical access hospitals in their communities. It's an essential component of the community, particularly in the small rural areas. We also have had for going on 30 years now the provision of inpatient psychiatric services. We also have a full continuum of outpatient services, which many communities don't have. We provide residential services, crisis and stabilization services, case management, and rehabilitative services. The nature of inpatient psychiatric care in Thief River Falls is acute. And acute, by definition, is short-term. We're not interested in long-term housing of patients requiring inpatient services. We move them through the inpatient setting and into more appropriate outpatient and residential services as quickly as possible. We have, in terms of providers, as of last July, we've recruited two additional psychiatrists to our facility, so we have three psychiatrists in Thief River Falls and a contingent of about 10 psychologists as well in our community providing services for in and outpatient psychiatric services. I would like to pause here and ask Casey to address some of the demographic analyses that we've done and support for this initiative.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Casey Johnson, and as Brian said, I'm the CFO at Sanford Health in Thief River Falls, and have been doing quite a bit of work, not only internally looking at data, but also kind of looking at the stakeholders in Northwest Minnesota and how they access care and what might benefit the entire region. To start out with, we understand that we need to be brief here, and as this is an exception to the moratorium, I'll try and kind of keep it simple and open it up to questions amongst the representatives and let you guys kind of dictate where we dive into more detail. Really, I think the question comes down to, is there real demand? And we have a list of supporters that includes basically from our, as we're defining our primary service area, all the county social service agencies and all of the medical providers, hospital providers in the region, including the CBA, the state-run CBHH in Bemidji, the administrator of that facility, have written letters of support. We believe that we can expand the existing capacity of our 10-bed psych inpatient unit to hopefully keep patients closer to home and get them back into the community-based residential services or ERTS facilities that have the potential to rehabilitate them to a better quality of life quicker. We don't want to keep people in the inpatient setting, but we're sending people out of the region, and maybe that's contributing to some of the access issues in places like Anoka and elsewhere in the state. So we believe there's real demand, and that's why we've got the support for this. The second question is kind of, are we putting the resources into the right place? We have a project that we think we can economically add capacity to psychiatric inpatient services for the region, but we're also trying to expand our community-based services and ERTS, capacity at the same time. So we think Sanford Medical Center, Thief River Falls, is trying to address the problem in the region, not just on the inpatient side, but also outpatient and community-based services as well, and we've demonstrated that over the years. So just kind of a technical note on why the proposed legislation is written the way it is. We do operate a 10-bed psychiatric inpatient unit as part of our critical access hospital today. In order to expand, even one bed beyond 10, we need to spin off to a separate legal entity, to a specialty hospital, and we can't simply transfer licenses to that newly formed hospital. So we would need, 25 beds to get to 25 beds. We couldn't add 15 to get to 25. So,
okay.
I think with that, we'll open it up to any questions that you guys may have.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And before we go to questions from members, I just want to let the committee know that normally for this kind of request for a moratorium exception, the Department of Health does an analysis, and we usually hear the bill after we get that analysis done. In this case, we're hearing the bill before we have the analysis complete because we want the bill to make deadline. But obviously, we will have the that recommendation before the bill progresses, obviously, before it would get to the floor. But by hearing the bill today, we're just allowing it to progress so that we can take those steps and keep the bill alive. So
And thank you for that, Madam Chair.
Absolutely, Representative Fabian. So are there other questions from members, given that? Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm just glad to see hospitals stepping up to this critical need because we know it's a growing one. The one thing I'd ask that you check into before it goes to finance is just making sure that how you structure it and its size, it will be eligible for medical assistance. There's some issues related to that, and you don't need to address that today, but when we get to the Finance Committee, we'll want to maximize that if we can.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from members? Okay. All right. I'm not seeing any. So do we have other testifiers? Anyone who wants to testify for or against the bill? Actually, there is another testifier. I'm sorry. You're on the list even. Come on down. Mr. Ashley Wertman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Ben Ashley Wertman. I represent Mental Health Association of Minnesota. We have been concerned with moving people out of institutions and providing meaningful access to recovery since our inception. We have significant concerns about addressing the availability of inpatient beds by adding more to the system. We can add capacity, but unless we deal with systemic issues of discharge settings and intake, we can be right back where we started. As many of you may recall from the DHS report on Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, one of the key obstacles that they list that keeps people in that setting long after they need a hospital level of care is a lack of adequate and coordinated community services to support individuals' recovery in their community. Hospital settings of care are strained across the state of Minnesota, but what we know from these reports is that the community settings have been the stumbling stone for patient flow and bed availability. Lack of these settings that allow people to recover and not head back towards readmission. Other people have been discharged from Anoka into homeless shelters or into AFCs that don't have the ability to really handle their issues. These bottleneck issues at Anoka, the CBHHs, including Bemidji, spread throughout the system, and they impact every inpatient setting within the state. We believe that in order to provide for adequate hospital beds, it involves community settings more than it does new construction. Inpatient care comes at a high cost, around $1,000 a day, and that's true for Anoka as well. It is an absolutely critical and necessary part of the system, but we cannot afford the human or financial costs of inadequate community services to support a full continuum of care. We've taken some really tough cuts in community services over the last few years. The Mental Health Association of Minnesota is strongly in favor of reinvesting there first. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. So any questions from members? Let me just ask, is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Ms. Abderholden? Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. Our board has not taken a position yet on this. We're actually meeting Thursday night. But there were a couple of questions that came to mind, so I'm not testifying against or for it, but just a couple of questions that I think we need to keep in mind. One is certainly the issue of Medicaid. Anything over 16 beds is considered an institute for mental disease, and so you can't use Medicaid dollars. The second thing is just recognizing the difficulty we've had with our own community behavioral health hospitals that have been capped at 16 beds, and they are often not full. And part of the reason is they found they can't take people who have aggressive behaviors and symptoms because you don't have enough staff to be able to come when you need them, you know, because you're a little bit more limited in that way. And also people who have a co-occurring medical condition because the rest of the hospital isn't there. I absolutely agree. You know, we have a huge demand for mental health services in our state at all levels. I agree with Ben that we do need to certainly do the community side as well. That prevents future hospitalizations. But I think we just need to be thoughtful about what models we develop in the future so that we can really be able to care for the folks that really need that level of care. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could direct a question to the Sanford folks. Those last two testifiers raised some questions about, one, just can these cost out? I assume that Sanford has figured that this can cost out. And can you talk about that and how you see this? Do you see this filling to capacity? I would also like clarification related to that. Is this 15 additional beds or is this 25 additional beds?
Okay. Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair. And the request is for essentially 15 additional beds, so we'll have a total of 25. We have 10 currently, but as Casey had mentioned earlier, because of the stipulations under CMS guidelines for distinct part inpatient psychiatric units, we're limited to 10 beds under that, under the critical access legislation. So it's actually requesting 15 additional into our 10 that we have currently. As far as costing, you know, out the program to that question, we have evaluated the cost of care question. We're very aware of the 16-bed limitation and the exclusions that come into play in terms of going beyond 16 beds, and have no intention of ever becoming an IMD facility, which is what you would be if you go beyond 16 beds. So we're aware of the costs. We also have, as I stated earlier, a full continuum of care in Thief River Falls, the outpatient side. Our length of stay, in fact, in the inpatient psychiatric unit right now, within the last 5 years, has decreased 30%. Our average length of stay 5 years ago was about 8 days, and today our average length of stay is about 6 to 6.5 days. So we are doing everything we can to move individuals to a more appropriate care setting as quickly as possible, and continue to expand and grow our outpatient and community-based services to be able to do that.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The continuum of care, and you mentioned that before. Did they inform the planning on the additional beds? Did you involve other sec? Can you describe the planning, the community planning that informed this decision to seek the expansion?
Sir Chair, we had pretty extensive strategic planning with all factors of our services offered, which include the community-based services, the people that run the ERTS programs and the crisis management programs. Also, we participated in, we conducted our own health needs assessment, which is kind of part of a kind of an obscure IRS requirement of critical access hospitals now that's coming into play. But public health agencies are to do this as well. And in our public interest review, we participated in what I think was 8 counties worth of public health agencies' community health needs assessment reviews, and we did it as part of a consortium. And in the public interest review, which you'll see, when it's completed, we've submitted a lot of documentation that came out of that said, there's a severe lack of access to mental health services across the spectrum, and inpatient was one of those. Inpatient is something that we see. We've documented, 340 turnaways in a single year for simply not having the appropriate access. We're full, or we're close to full, and we think we have an emergency type situation coming in, so we're sending them down the line.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my question of, I'm curious, how large a geographic area do you serve?
Mr. Johnson.
Sir Chair, I think it's in the document that we serve the entire state. We're talking about defining our primary service area a little bit larger than we have typically, going from kind of Polk and Mahnomen County east to Beltrami and then straight north. And the way that we define it's about 150,000 people. And the rate of admission for that region of the state is about 30% less than the rest of the state. And, based on what we're hearing, the input that we've got from county social service directors, from our, the Northwest Mental Health Center, other agencies that provide the outpatient and community-based services, the need is not, manufactured. It's real. And it's difficult to get those people back from Anoka or where they might go if we're not available, or the CBHH in Bemidji isn't available. How do they get reintegrated into a support system that's familiar to them? And if we can add a few beds and help them out, the outcomes will improve. That's kind of the whole idea behind it.
Representative Johnson. Representative Abler.
Oh, thanks. And I'm sorry I missed the beginning of the presentation. Just to disclose, I have a sister-in-law who works up there. So she's told me about some of the problems that they've had and some of the challenges. She's a psychologist up there. So just a couple questions. So it seems we're trying to find ways to have people actually live in greater Minnesota and actually stay there because they want to stay there and, you know, raise your kids and all that. And it seems like the more self-sufficient a region can be, the better that would be, and I'm sure the Department of Health will consider that in their capacity. And so it seems like if they can be served in their own locale within 50 or 100 miles, that would be desirable for a person who's having those kinds of challenges. But can you answer this question about this IMD business? So if you go to 25, does that mean Medicaid doesn't pay, or are these short enough stays that doesn't count as the IMD?
Mr. Johnson.
Oh, sorry. Sir Chairman, what our understanding is that you cannot have more than 16 beds for, you know, psychiatric inpatient services between the ages of 21 and 64 or something is the way the law reads. And it's kind of vague, and it's unclear to us exactly how it's been implemented in, you know, historically. And part of the reason that we're asking for 25 beds is essentially we have capacity for 25 beds. The existing hospital structure, you know, has 25 beds. It would be easy to remodel and economic to remodel it into another 25-bed facility. Granted, there would be different amenities for these types of services, but our thought was if we could operationalize 16 beds for psych services, maybe we could use those other licenses for chemical dependency or detox, or maybe we don't need. But it seems kind of unclear how the IMD has interpreted or implemented or the federal Medicaid body that would enforce that law, because my understanding is it's a federal Medicaid regulation, and it's been kind of inconsistent across states as to how it's been enforced or whether it's been enforced or if chemical dependency counts or doesn't. So that's the reason that we're asking for 25 beds. We understand that if we do what we're doing today with more than 16 beds, we would be an IMD. We want to avoid that because that's counterproductive to our aim, which is to provide better access and keep people closer to home in northwest Minnesota.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. And so, and I don't mind, I like it when projects evolve and as they get input from different groups and stakeholders and all that. And, you know, if your average stay is 6.5 days, they're not really being warehoused there in any length of time. It's here they are, their crisis, and then you're getting them plugged into something, support structure, compared to Anoka, where they spend extra months trying to find somewhere to take them. I live across the river from, you know, so I know it pretty well. You wouldn't want to forego the Medicaid piece. You're not in a position to do that, so you'd have to actually mean, if they said 16 is an IMD and 17, or 17 is an IMD, then you'd have to stop at 16 and that'd be the end of it. And then try to find some other use for those other 9 beds. And so even to build a bed requires a moratorium exception. Is that right? And so you're looking for 25 beds of some capacity, of some use, 16 for sure to do your psych beds, and then 9 for something else. Is that kind of to summarize your proposal?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, that's essentially what we're looking at.
And Madam Chair, just more. So Representative Abler. Is there a need for chemical dependency beds up there?
Mr. Johnson?
Yeah, I mean that's another one of the heavily identified needs in the area, and that is there was some confusion about, you know, were there psychiatric beds that closed in the region that have brought this about? No, but there was an inpatient chemical dependency center in Crookston, Minnesota, Glenmore, that did close, and the way that's impacting us is really, you know, a lot of people that have chemical dependency needs also have psychiatric needs. And when a resource like Glenmore goes away, ERs are kind of stuck. Emergency rooms are oftentimes stuck with trying to detox these people because, you know, maybe they can go to Nevis, maybe they can't, or, you know, there's not a lot of capacity in the state for detox services. And so if you're going to have to detox them in your emergency room anyway, you might as well hold them until their blood alcohol content or they're in a condition where they're medically stable enough to admit them to Thief River Falls, the psychiatric inpatient facility, because they have both diagnoses. And so we've seen an increase in referrals for people who maybe would have gone to detox and been handled by, you know, some other facility in the past. It's not that psychiatric beds have gone away, but when those chemical dependency beds or detox beds go away, it stresses out the rest of the system, because a lot of these are the same people.
Representative Baker.
My just final thought. Well, I appreciate this, and it seems to me that no area of the state should go lacking just because they're in a certain area of the state. When we look for health care in my neck of the woods here, which is Anoka in the Northwest Metro, there's no lack of anything. We have a choice. We can shop and make choices up there. You don't have that same luxury. And so I think it's important that if we're giving flexibility, that, you know, the Department of Health, I think, has to weigh in on this at some point. But I hope that we can do that. And I hope that, but also to the two witnesses, I hope that you can listen to the last two people who came forward and acknowledge those concerns, which I think you probably mostly have. But just make sure that you chat with them as this goes forward. Because you need the community facilities, and I'm sure your counties are working on that up there too, with the same challenges that Metro One faced. So I think it's a proposal we should advance, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Abler. Other questions for members? Okay, not seeing any. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2314 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. We've got House File 2797, Representative Loeffler. And Representative Loeffler is going to move that House File 2797 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moved. And what this bill does is it deals with an issue that doesn't arise that often, but for the people for whom it does arise, it's a really big problem. And that's a situation where someone is in receiving long-term care services, oftentimes an elderly person, but it might be someone younger as well, who has an outstanding order for spousal maintenance. In the old days, we might have called that alimony. And the situation that we have is one part of DHS collects that directly as part of our child support and other support collection system through automatic income withholding, and sends it to the spouse who's dependent upon this. But in determining the person who is paying that support's eligibility for medical assistance, there's no adjustment. And so typically you would have, just given the demographics of who we're talking about, typically it would be a gentleman in the nursing home or other long-term care services who is put in an impossible situation, because his income is calculated as having more dollars than literally are there, because another part of DHS has removed it from his access. And with me I have Melinda Lugdo from Legal Services Advocacy Community, and she can explain further and answer questions. But it's a small problem, but it's really important for the people who are caught in this.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. Representative Loeffler has laid out the issue fairly well, and I want to thank her for picking up this bill and helping us get something done with it this session. I'll give you a little visual. Is usually the money, in the cases we see, it's being withheld from the person's Social Security. So it's withheld up here. The person becomes wants to become eligible for MA. They've spent all their private money and now looking at MA. And for MA, it's still considered available to them. And it's not available because it's been withheld up here. And there's no way for them to spend it down. And so we have them caught in this kind of perpetual loop. So the way to make it unavailable is to add it to the personal needs allowance. And so that's what we did with the language. So that's what the bill does. Like I said, we've seen it in several cases. It also has stabilized the spousal maintenance obligation for the recipient, because we've seen cases, too, where the recipient then is asked to, in some cases, contribute back to their former spouse's care because they received the money. If they're also MA eligible, it's counting in their eligibility, too. So we're actually counting it twice in some of these cases for the obligor and the obligee if they're both on medical assistance. So we wanted to get this straightened out, cleaned up, and hopefully that will take care of this issue and help some folks along the way. So, thank you.
All right. Sounds like a neat trick if you can get away with it. Counting it twice. Maybe we can make all kinds of funny money for our budget that way. So, any questions from members? No, seeing none. Okay, so anybody in the audience want to testify for or against the bill? All right, not seeing anybody. So Representative Loeffler is going to renew her motion that House File 2797 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. All right, who's taking over here? And I got to go. They need me. What did I just do? Okay.
That's okay. Where are we at here? Okay. Sure.
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan moves House File 2396 shall be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then you have a DE1 amendment.
I'd like to move my DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like, please, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Okay, I will move the DE1 amendment. And do you want to describe what the amendment is before we vote on it?
We'll describe it in the process here, if we could, Mr. Okay. Chair. So I just want to get the bill in the shape that's going to work.
All right.
Here.
Then we'll vote on this. All those in favor of putting this bill in the form that the author would like, vote aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is a bill that I'm sure most of you have seen at least once in another committee. There are three of us who are shepherding the bill through the process to make deadline. The three bills are going to be married together, if you will, in the Ways and Means Committee. Eventually, Representative Mary Murphy is going to be the author who takes the bill across the finish line, hopefully. The bill is designed to help active duty military members and their spouses to make cleaner and quicker transitions in their professional lives as they move into the state. I have Don Kerr from Military Affairs here, who will talk a little bit more about the need for the bill, and then I'll talk about some of the changes that we adopted in the DE1 amendment, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Okay. If you will identify yourself, and welcome, by the way, identify yourself for the record.
Thank
Proceed.
You, Chair. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs, and the agency does support the bill. It will not directly enhance our members' benefits, but we do see the coming downsizing the active component of the military in all branches. There will be a lot of service members who will be transiting active duty and will have to pick a place to come back and contribute to the economy. And we think this reduces barriers that will help them make a decision to perhaps come to Minnesota and become part of our great clan here.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Albright.
For the author, I understand that this is to expedite the relicensing or issuance of a new license. I'm just wondering what credentials would need to be produced in order to validate that the license isn't woefully inadequate from the standpoint of, like, continuing education or the reciprocity that might be from another state if he's moving in or he or she is moving into a different state with different requirements.
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, let's take a look at the DE1 and I'll talk a little bit about what we're really trying to do here. In Section 1 of the DE1, we are expediting the license processing. So we are not saying to the licensing boards that you have to change your standards. These families, these military folks, they don't want standards lowered. They want to meet the high standards and that we have here in the state of Minnesota. So this would apply to active duty military members, spouses of active duty members, or an inactive veteran who has left service in the last 2 years. We are asking essentially for them to go to the front of the line so that they can more easily and readily and quickly transition into life here and help support their families in Minnesota. The second section of the bill is a report on temporary licensure. We were running into some trouble with the cost of rulemaking that the previous bill initially had for rulemaking on temporary licensure. And so that's the change here. We are asking the governor will appoint or designate representatives of the licensing boards to present a report to the legislature, as it says down there on lines 1.21 through 1.24, about how we can best go about facilitating the process of temporary licenses. So the legislature will receive a report from the licensing boards about ways that we could pass forward, that we could work on these temporary licenses that would make it even easier. And, of course, my hope would be, and I'm sure yours would be, Representative Albright, that we do not lower our standards for any of these areas. And I believe that that's what the military folks want as well. I think they want to meet Minnesota's high standards. They just want to have the process be a little easier.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, what types of licenses would this pertain to specifically then?
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, as it says in the bill, it's Section 214.01, Subdivisions 2 and 3. The reason it's in this committee is the health licensing boards, all of the different health licensing boards are contained in those sections. I actually had the sheet that had the list that I could read for you, but in the break between here and there, I think I put it in the wrong folder in my folder, and they aren't there anymore. But they are in that section of law. And if you really wanted, I'm sure staff could look them up for us right now. So, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifier, I think actually my question is this, you know, I go way back to veterans' preference. So this is on that order. You know, in the fire department, fire service, police service, we had that. There was points. In the old days, I don't know if they still do it. But this is along, would this be along that line?
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, not really. This really has more to do with professional licensing across the board. The veterans' preference laws are still on the books, and they do apply to civil service positions that are hired. But this really is more broad than that and also applies beyond the veteran into the military spouse category as well.
Okay.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so then if we're looking at, I'd like to know, too, who we're licensing, you know, in what area, and then is this also applicable to the fire service and police licensing?
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the reason that the bill is written so broadly is because Minnesota is so expansive in its licensing requirements, and there are a number of agencies, boards that all do professional licensing, and, of course, all have very differing standards, and that was the challenge in trying to come up with a bill or some sort of legislation that would not be 87 pages of specific tasks, but rather left it up to the board's authority to simply determine a process within the original or existing standards that they already maintain to expedite the licensing, if possible, for each of the different disciplines.
Representative Fritz?
That's good. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Yes. Are there others who would like to testify on this particular bill? See from the committee? Yes. Are there others who would like to testify on this particular bill? Seeing none, Representative Morgan, you have a closing comment.
It's a good bill for veterans and military folks. Please vote for it.
All right. See no more questions, no more testifiers. So I renew the motion. Representative Morgan renews his motion that House File 2396, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Franzen. Representative Franzen moves that House File 2977 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Franzen?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to committee members. I have an A2 amendment I would like to move to get the bill into the proper proper shape.
All right.
The amendment came from Senator Franzen's office, and so we worked together on this. We just want to make sure.
Okay. So Representative Franzen moves A2 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she would like it to be heard. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? All right.
Great. Mr. Chair and committee members, this amendment basically not only will the letter go out to last known address, but it will also go to the last known email. This also could prevent bad actors from taking advantage of a lenient system that at times the process can drag out on. So moving to House File 2977, I've thankful for the department to allow me to carry their bill. This bill does four things, members. First, it requires a written request for reconsideration of a correction order to be received by the Commissioner of Health within 15 calendar days of the correction order receipt. Also, it changes the level or the requirement for the commissioner to suspend a license to the determination of a level 3 or level 4 violation. And members, you will know that level 3 violation is one that endangers the client's health or safety, not including a serious injury. And level 4 is a violation is one that results in serious injury, impairment, or death. So this allows for a suspension of a license based on determination of a level 3 or 4 violation. The third thing it does is it requires the commissioner to request assignment of an administrative law judge within 15 days, and also requires the commissioner to request assignment of an administrative law judge within 5 business days of receiving a timely appeal. And with that, Mr. Chairman and committee members, we'll stand for questions.
Good. And so any questions for the author? Or yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, this is more for you. The A1 amendment, was that an author's amendment as well?
We're skipping that one.
Okay, that's it.
Representative Schumacher was an old version, apparently.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Thanks. I just have a question about the 15-day request for reconsideration. Currently, there's no time limit for reconsideration. Whoever that.
Mr. Chair.
Hi. Would you like to probably introduce yourself for the record?
Members, my name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Division of Compliance Monitoring in the Health Department. I'd be happy to answer Representative Ayler's question. Right now, there is a just to back up a little bit, there was a significant overhaul of our home care licensing system in 2013, and along with that, we introduced a correction order reconsideration process, and we omitted to have a deadline in there for requesting the reconsideration. That's what that 15 days is for.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, and so, it's good to have a time limit. Are the people fully aware of this opportunity, and would anybody fall off if they don't? I mean, do they all know it's 15 days? They better get going on this, and or do they might need some more time? And is that seems like a short window?
Ms. Winkleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, the reconsideration process goes with the new correction order process that we have for, we're in a transition window right now. So for licensees who are licensed December 31st of 2013, we're in the process of formulating the procedures to have the reconsideration of correction orders, and all of that information is being provided to those providers now as part of our new procedures for the home care licensing and correction order and reconsideration.
Well, I don't know what the right number is, but I've done a fair amount of licensing with you and the DHS and all, and sometimes these individuals are pretty naive to the process, and so I would hate to have somebody lose their chance just because you made up a number that wasn't a necessary time frame. And so if you think that they're going to be notified and nobody's going to lose their chance to have a valid reconsideration, I don't mind the time frame. That's just the basis of my question.
Ms. Winkleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, the time frame of 15 calendar days was agreed to by the three home care provider organizations specifically, so we did have the conversation. Yeah. But the reconsideration of the correction order is one of the timelines that's set by this bill, and the other parts of the bill affect the timelines for having an appeal process. So I don't know if that's part of what you're asking or not.
No,
Representative Abler.
I'm glad that three groups agree. I just that as nice as you have been to work with over these many years, many people are intimidated by the Department of Health. If you can believe that.
Well, I wasn't going to carry the department bill with a lot of drama beforehand. So,
if they're good, I just wanted to raise a question. And I predict somebody will be carrying a bill to make it 30 days. So, freshmen, listen up. There's a future bill coming for you, I bet. So, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Winkleman, I'm delighted that you're moving up how fast we handle serious violations. But I noticed in the handout, and I didn't hear that it was being addressed in the bill, that contested case appeals, as opposed to, you know, a temporary suspension hearing, can often take more than 1 year to complete. Is that still true? And what would be needed to speed that up like you've sped up the other components in this proposal?
Ms. Winkleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler. Let me kind of review a little bit more about the timelines that we're changing through this proposal. There's a contested case appeal process, as you referenced, for revocation, suspensions, and a license renewal denial. Those are more permanent effects. And right now, there is no timeline set in statute for getting into a hearing. And so while in the home care licensing program through the Department of Health, because we just had our very significant license overhaul and we're in transition period now, we only have a track record of 2 contested cases, but one of them did take a year and a half. We went to DHS licensing for some of that information about how long these contested cases take, and they, based on their most recent 10 revocation actions taken, on average, the contested case took a year and a half, and in one case, nearly 3 years. So that's for the most serious of our actions that have a more permanent effect. We also have a temporary suspension authority that's currently in statute, and we're also shortening that timeline. There is a timeline for getting into a hearing now of 90 days. And through this proposal, it would be 30 days.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Winkleman, I am pleased that you're moving everything up. I just felt like, you know, getting things resolved so you know whether or not you have a provider in your community or you have to recruit someone new in, and, you know, just getting things settled would be, I think, useful for everyone concerned. And so I'm glad you're moving in that direction and continue to look for other opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee, any other questions for the testifier or the author? Anyone in the audience wish to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Franzen, any final comments or shall we move it?
It's a good bill. Everybody vote yes.
Okay. Representative Franzen then removes her motion, House File 2977, be referred to the Committee on Government Operations as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Passed. And now that I'm in control here, I think I can declare an adjournment.